1, 2, 3. So this is Talking with Frank Kerr, part 3, on 26th February 76 at the University of Maryland. And would you just say again what you said about Westerhout's reference to your trying to detect the galactic plane during the war?
Okay, something about 1944, I guess. We thought of trying to put together some radar-type equipment with the Yagi and the 200 megahertz receiver, in those days 200 megacycles. And it didn't really come to anything because of the pressure to do something else before the job was complete, although I certainly started to get the equipment together.
And you never really got on the air.
And however, at about the same time, Ruby Payne Scott and Pawsey tried out something on the roof of the lab building to detect, I suppose again, about 200 megahertz emission from the sun. And they got a signal, but again, I believe it wasn't carried very far. It was just...
This was before they knew of any detections of the sun? They just...
No.
They'd heard about Reber's or Hayes'...
I guess it was after Hay's result.
Mm. I'll have to try to ask Payne Scott about that.
Mm. Actually, Hay and Southworth, at least their results, both came through to us during the war.
Right.
They came through on the classified network.
I still haven't gotten a hold of those reports, but I'm going to dig them up somewhere. I want to see what they say. Okay, so let's skip ahead now to your non-radar work, which I guess begins with galactic hydrogen, but you tell me.
Well, I was working on radar essentially until 1950, when I went to Harvard for a year. This was an idea of spending a year with some astronomers, and I guess I learned something useful in that time. It happened that during that year, the first detection of the 21 centimeter line was made at Harvard. That's by Doc Ewan. And I was right there at the time, so that was quite interesting. And actually Van der Hulst was there.
So yeah, I talked to him about all of that, so
yeah,
heard a lot about that.
And so we heard the news on the morning of March 25, 1951, and so both together went from the observatory to the physics department, and I spoke to Purcell and Ewan. I saw the equipment again. We'd actually seen it before, and at the time it wasn't doing anything. It wasn't receiving anything positive, I mean. And on that morning, Purcell was, of course, very pleased with the result, but he felt it wasn't really established well enough to publish straight away, and especially as Van der Hulst and I were there, he suggested that we should send cables to our respective places to ask them to confirm it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the Dutch were just about there anyway, and so they were able to receive the signal also. Short time later, perhaps two weeks later. And in the case of the Australians, they had not started any actual work trying to find the hydrogen line, but they were a quite well-established place, so there was a lot of equipment around. And Christensen and Heinemann were given the job by Pawsey of trying to do that. So at Potts Hill, in a trailer and using a broadside array, I think it was, that had been used on solar work. In that trailer, they lashed together a 21 centimeter line receiver in 6 weeks. And they detected the line also. That's the reason for the joint publication by three places.
And Purcell held off until
that
detection.
There's an interesting sideline to this, and something This happened just recently. I got a letter from Bad Bach about a week or 10 days ago. It was really in reply to a long one I'd sent to him on other matters. But he said that he'd heard that Purcell and Ewan were planning to run a 25th anniversary celebration at Harvard this year. And he wondered if I had been invited to it yet. I have not, by the way, but I don't know if it's really carried through very far just yet.
Yeah.
But the interesting sideline point I was going to make was that Purcell was in a bit of a quandary as to who to invite to it from Holland. Because Oort has never admitted in print that Ewan and Purcell made the first discovery.
I see.
So after 25 years, things are still slightly patchy there.
I see.
If you don't mind, I'll open this door so I can
okay.
get it. So that was March 1961, and I got back to Sydney, I suppose around September or so, and by that time Christensen and Heinemann had carried out their first quite quick survey of the southern Milky Way that came out in a paper in the Australian Journal. And at that time, or in that whole period, Christensen's main interest had been in the Sun. So he just wanted to divest himself of the 21 centimeter stuff and get back to the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came into it largely because I'd been involved, and I was interested in that anyway. And so I joined forces with Heinemann.
Mm-hmm.
And we started towards the setting up of some rather better equipment. The first antenna, as I said, I think was a broadside array. Yes, I think that antenna was really about 15 feet diameter, but there's a picture of it in the Christensen and Heinemann paper,
mm-hmm.
in the Australian Journal, 1951 anyway. So we were set to, and had built for us a 36-foot dish. It was built by the people at the lab. It was set up at Potts Hill, which was a place belonging to the Water Board in Sydney. It's where Christensen already had his solar stuff, and where the first prototype Mills Cross had been tried out. So we set up a 36-foot dish there that was a transit instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of rough and ready in the way it was made, but it proved to be quite useful. And we had four channels only in our receiver.
Well, that was four times more than some other people had.
Yes, true. Of course, the Dutch, when they started, had one channel, but they tuned that right across the band slowly. We thought we'd improve a little bit and have four.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was a transit instrument, of course, all the observations were taken by just allowing the sky to drift past. So there was constant declination scans on these four channels. And then we'd move across the following day through a shift of three channel widths mm-hmm. and so on until we crossed the whole band.
Right.
And after we got this working, we thought we'd look at the Magellanic Clouds to begin with.
Well, that was your first thing to look at, I see.
Sure enough, we had a very nice surprise, especially in the small cloud. We found that the profile was much stronger, much higher brightness temperature than we expected, considering that the small cloud at that time was supposed to have no dust in it. So we assumed we'd made a wonderful discovery of a place with a quite different gas to dust ratio.
Were you expecting to detect probably both of them when you started out, or did you really have no idea?
I don't think we had too much idea, but we thought we should see it in a large cloud anyway, because there is known to be dust there. Actually, in both clouds, it was rather stronger than expected. And also we soon found that there's a lot of stuff in between the clouds where there are no stars known to belong to the clouds.
Now this association with dust, that really wasn't established at that time for 21 centimeter emission, but just on basic optical arguments about gas and dust going together, or based on optical studies. Is that correct? Or?
Well, it depends exactly what you mean by it not being established from 21 centimeter studies.
At that time?
It was not established in detail, I suppose, no. But I think everybody expected, that there was a basic expectation that the gas and dust would go together in approximate proportionality.
Close confined to the plane, of course, and so forth. Yeah.
And there was never any surprise to anybody when the correlations between gas and dust were shown, I guess 2 or 3 years later, really. So this business of an apparently different gas to dust ratio in a small cloud was quite interesting. And of course, also the very large envelope of hydrogen all around the two, and an apparent bridge across between the two clouds. And then we also went on and in cooperation with de Vaucouleurs at Mount Stromlo, studied the kinematics and showed that the large cloud very definitely it was rotating, and we could get something about the mass and mass distribution.
Further out than optically it could have been could be done? Or?
Yes, although not so much further out, just it was better data because it was more smoothly distributed over the whole object. We had more kinematic information.
That was de Vaucouleurs and you, I think, in 57 or something like that, that was published? Somewhat later than...
I think 54, 55, that sort of region.
Was it early?
Or, I guess about 3 papers, so maybe in 56, the last one. In the small cloud, the rotation was not so certain because we couldn't see the turnover properly. But it was given the rotation type treatment anyway, and we got something out on mass limits, if nothing else. And then, let's see, I suppose around 54 or so, we finished our observing on the clouds and really got going properly on the galaxy. And went right around the galactic plane with our business of cutting across on constant declination lines. And thus carried out the first real survey of the southern galactic plane region.
Was this coordinated with the Dutch at all?
Well, sort of distantly to begin with. The first real coordination occurred in 57 when I went over and spent a few months at Leiden.
Yeah. We'll hear about that later, I guess, shortly.
It was only rather distantly coordinated, except that Oort was writing, I suppose, and urging that the southern Milky Way side should be finished off, because he had no interest in the Magellanic Clouds. He was interested to see the spiral structure worked out.
And you were the only ones doing hydrogen line work in Australia, is that right?
Yeah. That's right. And so we got cracking on to about 54, 55, and I guess completed everything by about 56. I can recall a special meeting we had in Sydney when Bart Bock first came out. He came out on a preliminary visit, really. He'd been invited to take over the directorship at Mount Stromlo, and he came out on a short visit of, I don't know, perhaps a couple of weeks, and established contact and work out what he thought needed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And on his way through, he stopped off in Sydney and visited us at the lab, and we turned on a bit of a symposium. I know I presented our first spiral diagram and the first evidence for the bending of the plane on both sides, and And he was terribly enthusiastic about it.
On both sides, you mean the what one normally thinks of as the northern side?
Well, what I mean by that is this was the first observational evidence for the bending on the southern side.
And which then made two sides.
And the first interpretation of the two sides as a single phenomenon.
I see what you're saying.
At the time when it was observed in the Dutch results, it was just a quaint phenomenon. You couldn't you couldn't do anything about it. It needed the two sides, really.
Now, in your survey, were there any different twists than the Dutch survey, or was it pretty straightforward as to how to carry out the survey and all the difficulties were in the interpretation?
Well, the principal difference was in the use of constant declination scans.
So that was forced upon you, more or less.
Yes. And so we had to put together the a series of four channel scans and build those up into a common thing. Otherwise, I suppose we cover the same sort of country.
Yeah.
And because we were doing constant declination scans, it meant those lines were inclined to the galactic equator, which made it slightly more complicated.
Yeah, pre-computer days. Now, I'm a little bit hazy, I'm almost embarrassed to admit it, on exactly where this stuff was published. I know about your paper in Monthly Notices with Orton Westerhout.
Well, the first results, at least now, there are two or three short papers. There was one that was published by, I think, Kerr, Heinemann, and Carpenter. Martha Starr Carpenter was with us.
That little thing in Nature.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, I remember that.
That's the first thing, which was rather similar to that seminar presentation about. It's about, although the very first one of all, because Bart was so enthusiastic, he took back, or I sent to him after he went back, a paper about the twist in the plane to present at the AAAS meeting. That came the following Christmas, and Bernie Berg presented a paper at the same meeting, because he had gone far enough south in his observations here in Washington to recognize the symmetry involved.
The downturn there, I see.
The two sides. Then there was this one with Patty Carpenter. She's called Martha Starr, but her nickname is Patty. And then the sort of archive thing is in the Australian Journal. They're published by Kerr, Heinemann, and Gum.
And that was pre... What year was that?
That would have been around 57.
Okay.
That's Colin Gum. Then Colin went on and worked out the principal plane of the galaxy from our results and the Dutch results. Oh, first of all, I should say what I did. In 57, I was at Leiden from the end of June up till December. Carried over all our raw data, and we did a lot of work, again pre-computer days, in working out the spiral pattern according to the ideas that existed at that time. The principal difference between our two ways of working was that I considered the Dutch and had over-restored the data, in the sense in which the word restored is used in radio astronomy.
Right.
To try and get back the stuff that's lost through finite resolution. And And we in Sydney had gone through a long history of that from the Bolton and Westfold days.
And Bracewell's whole...
And Bracewell stuff and so on. And
you were leery of...
So I was in the climate in which you don't try to put back too much. But they hadn't quite gone through all that. And so they had tried to restore for the finite bandwidth primarily.
Right.
And slightly for the finite beamwidth too.
For the... can't remember the name of the edge velocity. What's the proper name for
The tangential velocity.
Right, that's what I'm trying to
think. Yes. Yes, they fitted models, and so which are interesting, but they're only one possible case out of a continuum. So a certain amount of arguing about that, but they accepted the idea that it could be done differently. So that map looks different on the two sides because of the different restoring, namely.
Well, it was different methods, but I don't quite see what you mean by looking different on the two sides. I mean, there's a discontinuity in arm pitch angles? Or
it looks different in character.
I see.
And many people have interpreted it as meaning that the Dutch had more detailed observations, when in fact they didn't.
I'll have to look at that again. I hadn't noticed that.
Yeah. And then...
But let me ask you something. Why was that paper, Monthly Notices, it's a very interesting paper, but it's not... It's a review paper more, a compilation sort of thing. Why was it not done up as a normal sort of journal paper?
Well, Ort had the invitation to write a review paper for them. That's the kind of stuff which is written very much in the quarterly journal these days.
Mm-hmm.
And because he had that invitation, the stuff was put out in that way.
He used it as a vehicle, and therefore the meshing of it and all never got written up properly, so to speak. Really the way that map was produced.
Strictly speaking, yes.
As much circulation as it's had.
Yes, that's true. In our own stuff on the Southern Observations only, we also didn't write it in very much detail because we were giving sort of prior publication and things in Nature, that style of publication. And so it wasn't, as you say, ever written up in full detail. That's true.
Another thing just popped in my head. Going back to Christensen and Hyman's survey, to be frank, I was unimpressed with it from an interpretational point of view. Well, I guess the point was that they missed completely what you could do with the kinematics.
Yes.
They just plotted brightness versus longitude. Was this Christensen, of course, it wasn't his game at all. I mean, and Hyman, I guess, of course, well, it was new to everyone.
Yeah.
I mean, was this all it was, that they were novices in terms of galactic structure, whereas you...
Sure. Yes, they were completely out of it in galactic structure and didn't really know anything about it.
Unfortunately, they didn't hook up with somebody that did, perhaps at Mount Stromlo or someone.
Yeah. I guess everybody was keen to get something out quickly, and at that time in radio astronomy, there was a great tradition for publishing results. They're sort of fairly raw, without too much interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of the early people in the subject were not astronomers.
Mm. So, skipping back to the survey, what would you say were the primary results of the survey? The downturn and then the interpretation of the warp of the galaxy in both sides. And what else was...
Well, I guess... The question of delineating the southern spiral structure for the first time, and the difference in the velocity patterns on the two sides of the sun center line was the other important thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That too, it took a while to convince the Dutch that it was real. They were skeptical
of your observations.
They're skeptical people. And, well, at that time, perhaps still they're skeptical of everybody else except for that.
But are you referring to the northern and southern rotation curves?
Yes.
Or that's one way of interpreting it anyway.
Yes. Yeah. If you compare the places where the two sets of observations overlap, the agreement was pretty good. So it was clear that the result was probably okay.
Yeah.
Now, however, the real proof of perhaps didn't come until a park survey some years later, in which the rotation curves on the two sides were done at the same place, the same techniques and everything.
Yeah, one is always suspicious when there are separate sets of data and they give different answers. Yeah.
Yeah. And perhaps that kind of attitude is stronger amongst optical people, because they've had their fingers burned pretty often in the past. I think on the whole, radio people are more inclined to accept other people's results, at least they were in the old days. So that you assume that the results are going to match together unless somebody proves otherwise. Optical people perhaps take the other point of view.
Mm-hmm.
They need convincing.
Do it themselves. Yeah.
The two surveys go together.
Now, was your total time pretty much devoted to this survey? I mean, it is a gargantuan sort of thing.
It was during that period, sort of. A Majorvanic survey plus the galactic survey essentially took most of the time between 52 and 57.
Mm-hmm.
And then, after I came back from Leiden, in 58, or at the end of 57, or those first weeks of 58. I guess then I was getting rather much involved in the planning for the Parkes dish. And because of my interest in high-frequency line astronomy, high frequencies as it was then, I was one of the few in the place who really supported Taffy Bowen in going towards this.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a period when he had his rows with
right.
Christensen and Mills.
You've told me about these.
And eventually Bowen. Yeah. But I was keenly in favor of it, and that was involved in the planning, and spent a lot of time in assisting in preparing publicity and cases.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even in 56, actually, some of my time in 56 went into preparing a sort of propaganda booklet which we used to sell the idea to the government and the foundations over here.
Right.
And then in the period 58 to 60, there was a lot of work. At the Sydney end, we had a sort of users committee, and I was chairman of that, and we spent a lot of time corresponding with the telescope designers who were in London, and our representative over in London was Manette, Harry Manette.
Mm-hmm.
And we put a lot of effort into trying to make the telescope as good as possible for the potential users.
Right. Good interface, as we say nowadays.
And that, I believe, is one reason why the telescope has been successful for so long, that we anticipated some things. For example, it was because of our suggestion and insistence from Sydney end that they changed over from analog displays to digital display systems.
Which was unusual at that time, yeah.
Probably the first time it was done, but that made a great difference in the convenience of operation of the system, and it meant that the control desk system has essentially lasted unchanged until now.
Yeah, now, before you did tell me about the development of the Parkes dish and so forth, so we don't need to repeat that, but I was wondering what you thought about what unique aspects were there. Let's forget that. The question I'd like to ask is, is why was the Australian government not willing to support it to the full extent when radio astronomy had been so successful in Australia? So they had to get American money.
Well, just because the amount of money involved was so high.
For a small country.
According to the standards at that time, nobody had ever thought of spending that much money on a telescope or a single project.
Was it much more than the Jodrell Bank antenna in total cost?
No, it was probably, probably only a little bit more, but the Jodrell Bank people were known to be in difficulties, financial difficulties.
Right.
And no other no other big telescope, optical or radio, at that time had ever been built at that sort of price, I think, by any government.
There's always been a foundation or something.
There've been foundations or private money building 100-inch, the 200-inch, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but it's not quite so simple as to say, why didn't the Australian government spend it? I think at that time there was no tradition towards it, and so it was much harder to convince them at that time than it ever would have been since.
I see.
And I guess also at that time there was quite a bit of contact with foundations in some other activities too, so it was a quite reasonable extension of the climate of the times.
Well, during this period, were you able to do any scientific research, or were you pretty much working full-time on the dish and so forth?
I guess I didn't do very much new observing at that time, but well, we're involved in the galactic coordinate business for part of that time.
That's right.
And a couple of other smaller discussion type papers, and the interpretation of the hydrogen line results and what they might mean, but nothing really large scale.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was large scale enough.
Well,
getting that dish going,
yeah. And then when the Parkes dish started up, I spent a lot of the first year in a way attached to the telescope as one of its first users and experts in quotes, and got used to the system fairly quickly and cooperated with some other people in getting projects started. For example, I spent some time on a flare star project that was in the sense of being a friend of the telescope, helping somebody else get involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two or three other such projects that I was involved in as sort of friendly outsider.
Was this after Lovell had detected a couple?
In the flare star case, was after Lovell, yes.
Right. And who was the person that was doing this primarily?
That was Bruce Lee and Charlie Higgins, I think, even way back then.
Oh yes, Lee and Higgins, I think. I do vaguely remember.
And I was involved in the start of a project with Eric Hills on a continuum survey. And then gradually got involved in more 21 centimeter work. Starting certainly by 62, perhaps late 61. And once the equipment was going, we sort of divided the field, that I was concentrating on the galaxy, and Jim Hindman on the small cloud, and Dick McGee on the large cloud.
I see.
But in fact, often the observational sessions were combined.
Yeah.
And we'd go... We'd go right around the 24 hours, either two or three of us.
Your interest, it seems, has been largely in surveys. Does that come about because of the nature of 21 centimeter work, or just your own personal nature that you like I mean, some people think in terms of surveys, you know, there are different styles.
Yeah, I suppose some of each. I've always been sort of unimpressed by the quick and nasty papers where people try and get a quick result overnight and publish it straight away, and it may or may not be right.
Yeah.
So I suppose it's partly my nature.
And this park survey began then very soon after the telescope got started, mm-hmm. and went for how long in the observing?
I guess the galactic part, being the longest of these three, kept up until sometime in 66, not long before I came over here.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when we came over here, we carried with us a lot of stuff that had only been half digested up to that stage.
Which I well remember, although I know it's never directly involved.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what would you say were the primary results from this park survey that had not been known before?
Well, I guess it could not do anything as dramatic as the discovery of the twisted edge of the galaxy, or the different rotation curves. There's more a question of making more definite and believable the kind of things that had come out of our earlier survey, and in giving more detailed results for people to compare with other kinds of observation.
Mm-hmm. When you talked about locating arms by the kinematical method and so forth, now actually going back to the first survey,
yeah.
How much, at that time, how much faith did you have in that you really were tracing out real structure?
Well, I suppose very early on, people probably had a great deal of faith in it. That's everybody involved in it. That and us too. That there was, certainly we recognized that there was uncertainty because of the velocity dispersion, that there was a 10 kilometer per second velocity dispersion on top of everything.
Right.
And so that all velocity, that the distance conversions were limited by that. And especially if you consider the region around the tangential points, in which you're looking over a fairly large line of sight, and so it gets smeared out by the distance through the galaxy, as well as being smeared out by dispersion.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that was recognized quite clearly, but that was just regarded as a smearing out of things. The question of really systematic non-circular velocities was not thought of early, I'm sure, as by anybody.
Yeah. And what about the question of what's now called velocity crowding? I mean, interpreting bumps in your profile and temperature as really density concentrations.
Well, the phenomenon of velocity crowding was recognized right from the start. It's if you look at the equations in the first Dutch papers, the appropriate terms are there, that the brightness temperature depends inversely on the gradient of velocity with distance.
Right.
So to that extent it was certainly recognized, that nobody ever considered the possibility that a feature could be entirely due to velocity crowding. It could be sharpened up, or the temperature's increased,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Through velocity crowding. But the possibility which people tend to talk of now, of an entire single feature being there only because of velocity crowding, is certainly not for them.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, the density wave theory was still way in the future.
Yeah, that's post my history anyway. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think one of the things people were very interested in at that time was the looking at the tangential points as seen on 21 centimeters and comparing those with the steps in the continuum, which also gave tangential points, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
and you could get the they could get similar evidence for the closest firearms optically, and so that was one important thing in those days. It, in fact, I think it's discussed in that monthly notice.
Right. Mills' Steps in the Continuum is the primary source, is that right?
That's about 58 or
yeah.
something.
Well, we're about up to 65 or so. Is there anything else that we've skipped over in your own personal field, or any other comments you'd like to make about development of radio astronomy?
Well, I guess the Magellanic Cloud work in the 60s from the Park Station is interesting too.
And I'll talk to, yes. to them about that.
Mm-hmm. And, oh, also at that time, sort of 64, 65 and so on, I said earlier I had been slightly connected with Eric Hill's the starting of a continuum survey at 21 centimeters. In 65, a continuum survey at 11 centimeters was started. And the first section of that was done by Maston V and then myself,
mm-hmm.
10 degrees a stretch of galaxy. And that was a sort of a pilot study also. In which we developed the techniques. I was in it as the astronomer, I guess, and he was in it as the engineer who was becoming expert in computing.
Mm-hmm.
And between us, we established what was probably the first really computerized continuum survey.
I see.
Now that was only a 10 degree strip, and it's been carried around. It's been carried around the whole region observable from Park since then,
right?
In a series of strips, and the whole thing is covered. And now they're doing a 6 centimeter survey, with Ray Haynes mainly involved, and it's more highly computerized still. In our survey, we did not. To control the telescope by the computer, it's just computerized data reduction.
Right.
But now the computer controls the telescope as well. Also in that time period, I was interested in a continuum study of 11 centimeters of the Carina Nebula. And that was one of the early ones where a comparison was made between radio and optical studies in that kind of situation. You can use the comparison between radio and optical to see if a dark region in a nebula is due to foreground dust or whether it's lack of excitation.
Mm-hmm.
And the Carina Nebula is interesting from this point of view because there are three dark regions running into it. And the comparison of the radio and the optical showed that of these three, two were due to dust, and the third one was due to lack of excitation.
Hmm.
Because the radio was present in the first two, but not
yeah.
in the third. Now that method has been carried much further by many people, but
yeah.
I think this was one of the first...
About what time was this?
About 64.
What about the possibility of other spectral lines? You were always working with the hydrogen line. Did you ever think about looking for some other ones? Or?
Well, a small amount of thinking was done, and I guess we kick ourselves now if we didn't do any more on it. And perhaps well, we're conscious of a couple of papers on this subject, one by Towns,
right.
and I think one by Shklovsky,
right.
and also a fellow called Yardley Beers was there.
You told me about this compilation he made. I'm going to try to get it.
And spent a few months and
copy of that.
He's got a compilation there. It was interesting, but nobody ever really followed it up too much, I'm afraid.
No one ever looked for OH in Australia. I mean, there were a couple of attempts by Barrett.
Yes, we heard about those attempts.